All right, folks, today's topic is what do we mean when we say God? So it's an important question. It seems like an obvious question when we say what do we mean when we say God? God is God, you know, how do we... So, but it's a significant question, and we'll see why shortly. We'll see in Maimonides why it's such a significant question. But before we perhaps address the question, I'd like to address something much more basic. I think by virtue of the fact that we're all in here, you know, we probably take it for granted that that we believe in God. You know, I would think that's probably a fair assessment of the group here. That, you know, you're in a Sunday school, a Jewish Sunday school. Step one is that you believe in God. You know, but the question though is what is the ultimate reason that we believe? I'm sort of looking. Why do we believe in God? What is the source for our belief in God? Somebody comes to you, they're an agnostic, perhaps they're even an atheist, and they say to you, why do you believe in God? So what would be the answer, perhaps, that you would give for why you believe in God? I'll throw that out there. Yeah, your coworker. Hey, I hear you're like a pre-religious person. Why do you believe in God?
I need a spiritual. I need somebody to look up to, and I need, and I think that somebody has to create and be responsible for everything that exists in our world.
Excellent. Okay, so he just gave two different answers. Okay, so the first answer was it fulfills a personal need for me, and second of all. And I look around the world, I see a world around me, and I have to ask, what's the first cause for that world? So I fill in the blank with God.
Yes. The classic answer you get is the watch and the watchmaker, right?
Okay.
You're walking along the desert on a planet that you've never seen before, and you kick over a watch. That can't happen by nature. There has to be a watchmaker, and
right.
There is a watch.
Right.
So the world, the universe is far too complex and far too balanced to be an accident.
Great. Okay, so we're going to call that, that's going to be called the anthropic principle or the design principle, that the world is too complicated to be here without some sort of designer. It's just design, perforce means this designer. Good. Anyone else have a reason why or what they would say, you know, to their coworker? And this is a logical conversation. You know, this is your, maybe this is somebody, you know, you want to give a logical reason. Why do you believe in God?
I would say, I believe there's something bigger than myself.
Yeah, but why?
Because I wouldn't be here.
Oh, good. Okay, so very good. So again, the first cause idea, how do we get here without some sort of creator? Excellent. You have another thing to add?
It's completely weird. I believe in a higher power.
Yeah.
I've come to say there is a higher power.
Yeah.
But I think, and having studied ancient alien television show for years, I think it's more from doodle, doodle, doodle somewhere else and has come down and created us and left, because most religions believe somebody from heaven came down from the heavens, they called it the heavens, and then rose back up.
Well, let's address that. We're going to come back to that point. That's an important point of whether or not God remains involved in the world.
I feel there is a higher power. It could be
whatever you want to call it,
alien in the sky, and it, he acts as the same as we call him God. It's like when Africans saw white people, they say, oh, they're gods.
Uh-huh.
You know, like
so it's important. It's important to kind of also, when we talk about God, and we're talking about the basic principles of God, to kind of see where did God come from, right? So in a sense, you're saying that God comes from out there. Let's actually, we'll come back to that and discuss where did God come from. So let's come back to that in a moment. First of all, but before we do that, that's going to be in the principles of what we mean when we say God. Let's take a step back though to the original question, which is how do we know that there is a God? So the answers that were given here are some of the answers that are already on your outline. The first one is what we have here as simple faith. Okay, simple faith. You know, why do I believe there's a God? Because I'm part of a faith that always believes in God. This is almost, I think, your first answer. In other words, what do you mean? My grandparents and their grandparents, and we had a Seder, and we talked about the Exodus and God taking us out of Egypt. That's why I believe in God. It's part of our tradition that we received from our ancestors, which today fewer and fewer people have, because there's been so many breaks in that tradition more recently, you know, where questions of, well, who says there was an Exodus, and who says there's a God, right? But for those who want to use that as their basis for their religion, I would not say that that's shallow. It should not be poo-pooed. You know, people will poo-poo that and say, well, who says your tradition is correct? You know, the fact that there is such a tradition itself, if it's evidence for you, it's okay. And it's actually a verse. The verse says, let's just read the verse for a second. In the outline there, it says, ask your father, he'll tell, relate it to you. Your elders, and they will tell you. There's a story of the Jewish people. You're part of that story. You're not coming in a vacuum. Anyone here who's part of the Jewish people has a piece of that story. And if you convert, you latch on to that story, but the story's there. The story's out there. It didn't exist in a vacuum, and we don't exist in a vacuum. So if our traditions are the source of our faith, then it's a verse in Deuteronomy. That's also a valid source for your tradition. It's not necessarily shallow. It can be deeply profound. And in terms of evidence, you can question it. Everything in here could be questioned in terms of evidence. You can come up with another argument. Maybe somebody made it up 2,000 years ago. Maybe, you know. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it's an attack. We're not necessarily looking for Cartesian proof. Cartesian proof means there's no other way to explain it. That's not how we live our lives. This is actually not a valid argument in this or really any class where we're trying to find the most logical assumption, the most logical truth. Anything in life, when we drank that coffee, we all drank it. And there's not a person here, I think, I hope not, who thought to themselves, you know, maybe it's poisoned, right? Why would you think it's poisoned? Because, well, I don't have Cartesian proof that it's not poisoned. I didn't see anyone watching it from the time it left the farm in Colombia till it got here that nobody poisoned it. But we all drink it, and we'll continue to drink it, and I see there's already people while I'm speaking drinking the coffee. You're okay with the coffee. You're not so worried. Because what we do is we look at probability. Probability is that Rabbi Moskowitz is not a psychotic person. Okay, that's number one. Probability is that that nobody in HEB, a blessed memory. But nobody at HEB poisoned the coffee. I mean, come on. You know, like, we'll go on with our life. So the probability of this faith that's been around for 3,300 years, and we've been transmitting the story over and over again about God appearing to the entire nation and giving us the Torah, it's pretty good evidence.
But that's the difference, you know, in Judaism between almost every other faith. Is it's not simple faith because we met him.
Right. Okay.
We met him at Sinai.
Good. I like that.
You can say that.
That's a good point. I'm going to put simple in quotes. Okay. You're right. Our faith is actually based on a historical incident, right? And we really don't have time to go into why that's proof. But because I want to get really into what do we mean when we say God. But there is a historical incident called Sinai, which no other religion has. Which is our ace up the sleeve. It really is our ace up the sleeve. How do you have an entire nation? How do you make up such a story that an entire nation witnessed speaking to God? You can make up a story of 1,000 people. You can make up a story of 20 people. But to have every single... Where do you put that story? Yeah. Where do you go to the people and say, by the way, all your ancestors were at Sinai. Who? Sinai? What? You know, who made up that story? When in history would you place that story? Why wouldn't everybody just go back to their bubby and say, bubby, did you hear anything about Sinai? Sinai? You mean the desert? What?
Black.
So, well, there's a prophet out there telling us that all of our ancestors... Mine weren't there. Let's go to the neighbors. Hey, well, your aunt? No, mine weren't there. Like, where do you put that story? Who made up that story? Isaiah, Jeremiah? They can't place that story. Too big a conversation to get into. Let's go to number two. Okay, let's go to number two.
There's a great cheer on it, though, on Simple
Numbers. So that's a whole hour. That's a whole hour talk. Let's go to number two, which is science. I want to talk about science. By the way, I have to be reading a book... On anti-gravity. I can't put it down. No, we're not going to talk about gravity, but we'll start by talking about the world around us, the universe around us, the stars, you know. The Torah itself suggests that we look at this. The verse says in Isaiah, lift up your eyes to the stars and see who has created these, right? And this really goes back to what was mentioned a few times earlier, which is the anthropic principle, that the intricate balance of life and its interconnectedness implies design. So our galaxy, what's the name of our galaxy? The Milky Way. Anyone know how many stars exist in our galaxy?
More than two.
More than two. about exactly about 400 billion stars exist in our little galaxy.
Hurry, I know that.
It's incredible that he always has the answer. He's just like he's like an encyclopedia. We'll call him Wicked David. All right. So now our galaxy, by the way, is not the only galaxy out there. We've got neighbors. How many galaxies are there? There are actually billions of galaxies. So you have 400 billion just in the Milky Way, but that's just one of billions of other galaxies in what we call the observable universe. The observable universe is what we are aware of, okay? We don't know what's beyond the observable universe, but the observable universe that we are aware of is estimated to be about 93 billion light years from edge to edge. Okay? That means from us, we're in our center point, we're looking out to the edges, which is about 46 to 47 billion light years to get to the edge. When we talk about a light year, that's the amount of time it takes for light to travel for a year, right?
47 trillion miles.
47 trillion miles. So now, how far away is the sun? Just to give you a little bit of the sun is only 93 million miles away. So if you start driving out and you go as fast as your car can go, you're still not going to make it. It's 93 million.
Well, to give you an idea of years, it's 8 light minutes. It takes light 8 minutes.
Yes. Right. 8 minutes and 19 seconds.
That's not going for a year.
Yeah.
And once you get there, you burn up. So
well, you burn up a long time.
Yeah, you probably don't want to get there. But don't worry. You're even if you're driving a Toyota, you're not going to make it. Now, what's the closest star, the next closest star to our planet? Isn't it Alpha Centauri?
It's in the Andromeda Galaxy, yes.
Okay, so Alpha Centauri is the next closest star. By the way, that's 4.37 light years away. Okay, so the sun is 8 minutes and 19 seconds away for the traveling of light. And when we talk about the light traveling to the next little stop in the galaxy, it's going to take it almost 4.5 years to get there. That's the next closest star. Okay, so that's just two stars in a galaxy of 400 billion, which is one of billions of galaxies. It's truly mind-boggling, right? So as the verse says, when I look up, lift up your eyes to the stars and see who has created these. I tried to do that one night. I actually, when I was a little kid, I stayed up all night to see where the sun went. And then it dawned on me. All right. Anyway, let's go to the next one. The next one is called the moral argument. So the moral argument goes like this, and you know the science one. Okay, if it moves you, great. If it doesn't, you know that's also fine. But the moral argument is perhaps one of the hardest ones to disagree with, and that's from this internal sense that we have that about a universal ethics. We believe in morality. We believe that everyone has to believe this as well, that murder, rape, theft, right, from innocent people, all that's bad. Why is it bad? Why is it bad? Lions do it all the time, right?
Take down a gazelle. Yeah.
They take down a gazelle. They steal from other lions what they killed. Yeah. Right? Why? Is that a flaw in us? If logic would actually dictate that I do what's best to achieve my ends, right? If we're talking about a logical world where the survival of the fittest, so it would make sense that the strongest of us should just go around stealing and taking whatever we want from whatever we want and however we want to do it because it's all about survival.
Well,
that's what.
We did it,
what?
Well,
we did.
Sure.
I mean, we did.
We still the Ten Commandments.
Yeah.
Okay. So yes and no. But there's still, even from the time of Adam, really, there's a universal morality called the Seven Noahide Laws, right? But that universal morality, a basic morality of not murdering and stealing from each other and committing incest, right? That's that basic morality. Where does that come from? What's the internal peace in all of humanity? Wherever you go, on all the four corners of this earth, you will find a certain basic rule of morality. Why? Fish don't have it. You know, lions don't have it. And it works for them. You know, it works very well for fish to go ahead and eat other people's, the other fish's young. You know, it goes to the neighbor fish, knocks on the door, and says, hey, can I just eat your children? And it just goes ahead and eats all its children. Right? You don't do that as human beings. You don't see that in any human culture. Why?
Well,
yeah.
I think they have a population of 8.1 billion.
because they're raised that way. But we have a conscience.
What do you mean?
What are the people?
So where does that come from?
What people?
Question. Why do we have a conscience?
There's one. What? What are you saying?
What people are you talking about that are still young?
That would kill each other's children?
That kill and don't care. That have no. They don't.
Oh, oh, oh! No, but
Muslims.
Oh, but they'll kill. You know, yeah, okay, true. But they still understand that the idea of murder, what they're all riled up about is somebody murdered one of their own, right? Mm-hmm. They get all riled up, somebody murdered one of our own.
So where
does the idea that that murder itself is immoral come from? If it's a survival instinct, it's not. That doesn't make sense. It doesn't work. Again, the animal kingdom is doing very well without this instinct.
So was that instinct absent in the time of Noah, which is why man had to be restarted?
It wasn't necessarily absent, but it was there was a breakdown in morality. There was a breakdown in morality, right? There are people who are murderers. There are people who are thieves. But at the end of the day, as society, as a culture, we understand that these things are...
They still have a conscience. They just choose to ignore it.
Right.
And where does it come from?
Where does the conscience come from?
Not innate.
So where does that innate conscience come from? Where does that come from? Why do we all agree that that killing a human being is different than killing a fly?
It was programmed into us.
But right, so
and
we call that program
our DNA to believe in a God, and I know
but
from
if you
my shows that I watch, I'm not going to go into that, but we're programmed to believe in a God and to have this morality.
So we're gonna not use the word program, but we're gonna use the word that the Torah uses, which is that God placed within us something called a tzelem Elokim, something that's made in the image of God. That we're made in the image of God. We have this soul within us, and that's the only universal, the only legitimate source, really, of a universal right. Let's look at the verse in Genesis. It's at the bottom of your first page there. It says, "Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. For in the image of God he made man." Okay. The reason God says to Noah, this is a verse to Noah, and he says, "Don't go and commit murder." Why? The answer is because in the image of God, he made men. Okay? Since we're made in the image of God, there's a specialness to humanity that's different than a cow, that's different than a dog, that's different than a fly. The human specialness is that each and every one of us has a piece of godliness within us. That, says the Torah, is the reason not to kill one another. And in fact, the authors of the Declaration of Independence understood that implicitly. Let's look at the next part of that box. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with inherent and inalienable rights, right? That where do we get these rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness? The answer is because we are at Tzelem Elokim, because we have this godliness within us. Okay,
and
so that's part one.
We kill someone, it's like killing a part of God.
Well, you're debasing that special creature which has a piece of godliness in it.
Okay.
How could you destroy that very special thing, right? Okay, let's go to the second aspect of our conversation, which is really the title of today's class. And that is the idea of how we define God. Okay, what do we mean when we say God? So we're going to, a lot of the rest of our class today is going to come from Maimonides, the Rambam. Has anyone here heard of the Rambam? Have you heard of the Rambam? Rambam, Maimonides, was one of the greatest Jewish thinkers and writers. He lived in the 12th century, 1138 to 1204. And he gave us something, among other works that he gave us, but he gave us the 13 principles of Jewish faith, right? So we're going to actually focus not on all 13 in this class, but we're going to focus and highlight the first four. The first four of those principles of Jewish faith actually help us answer the question of what do we mean when we say God.
We sing these every show.
Excellent. Very good. Yigdal. Yigdal is composed. Yigdal, the prayer Yigdal. Oh, and also they print in the back of many Siddurim, the 13 principles. But good. So those are the principles, the basics of Jewish faith. It's interesting that he lists these 13. Some argue that there's 613 principles of Jewish faith. Every single mitzvah is a principle of Jewish faith. But what Maimonides was trying to do was he's trying to say, why is Judaism unique? What makes these are like, if you want to give me Judaism in a nutshell, like what does Judaism believe? What is its theology? Says Rambam, the 13 principles are Judaism's theology. Others actually boiled it down to 3 principles. But we're going to go with the Rambam's 13. Those are the most classic. There is beeping outside, and it's driving me crazy, too. So, it's okay. I think it's a machine. They're working at the HEB.
Oh,
They're trying to bring it back to life.
No,
oh, I don't know. You can check. You can check.
No, that's them, the HUD.
That's the HUD people. All right. Let's talk about the first four basic principles of Jewish faith. Here we go. We're in that first box over there on that page. I believe with perfect faith that, number one, God is the creator and ruler of all things. That's principle number one. Okay, it's a pretty simple principle. We're going to get into it, actually, in much more detail. I want to just quickly run through these first four principles, and then we're going to break them down. Number two, God is one. It's ironic that that's number two. But God is one. There is no unity that is in any way like His. He alone is our God. Number three, God does not have a body. Physical concepts do not apply to Him. There is nothing whatsoever that resembles Him at all. And number four, God is first and last. Okay? God is first and last. We'll discuss what that means as well.
This whole idea of we were created in the image of God.
Oh, good. Number three does, right? Mm-hmm. Oh, we're going to come back to that. That was my discussion point for number three. We're going to come back to that. Let's go to the first principle. Let's break down number one. Okay, this is also from Maimonides. These points that you're seeing, they're actually quotations, literal quotations from his book called the Mishneh Torah. And this is in a section of the Mishneh Torah called Foundations of Torah, or Hilchos Yesodei Torah. So here we go. This is chapter 1, number 1. The foundation of all foundations and the pillar of all wisdoms is to know that there is a first cause, and He created all that exists. All that exists in the heavens and the earth, and all in between, only exists due to the reality of His existence. What does that mean? Oh, good. Okay, so on the most basic level, it means He's the creator, and without Him we have nothing. And everything exists only because He's real. We'll come back to that in just a second. Let's go to number two. If it were imaginable, let's say you could imagine, that He did not exist, then nothing else could exist. Perforce, nothing else could exist. Let's go to number three. If it were imaginable that nothing else but Him existed, He would continue to be and would not be negated in any way through their negation. This is because all of existence needs Him, and He, blessed is He, does not need any of them. Therefore, nothing is quite as real as He is. There He goes again with saying that there's something about Him being real. Okay, so let's just in a nutshell explain what we've got so far. We have Him as the creator. All things exist only because He exists, but He does not need anything else to exist. Does He need oxygen? No. Does He need light? No. Does He need space? Does He need time? Does He need anything? No, He needs absolutely nothing. Okay, therefore, nothing is quite as real as He is. Let's go to number four in this box here. This is what the Torah means when it says, there is none other than He. It's a verse in Deuteronomy. That is, right, Ein Od Milvada. That, bless you. That is, there is no true existence other than He and besides Him. Number five, this being is God of the world, Lord of the earth. His power is endless and limitless. And number six, the knowledge of all this is a positive commandment. As it says, I am the Lord your God. Where does it say, I am the Lord your God? That's a...
It says it a lot.
It's number one of the Ten Commandments. Anochi Hashem Elokecha. I am Hashem, your God, who took you out from the land of Egypt. Okay? The first of the Ten Commandments says Maimonides, right there. This is not the original. The original was broken. We don't know how it broke.
But
this isn't the second one either. This is a copy. And it's made out of wood. And it doesn't even have all the words. But it has the first two words, and it says, Anochi Hashem, I am Hashem, who took you out of Egypt. Says Rambam, that's a commandment. How many commandments do we have in the Torah?
613.
Says Rambam, and he actually writes that one as number one. This is commandment number one, is to believe in God. Okay? It's an interesting commandment. You can argue, perhaps, that that's a very strange commandment. Why would that be a strange commandment, to believe in God?
We're actually going
to make it concrete shortly. We already started making it concrete. Well, what do we mean, right? But
individualistic. It's not what, like in America, where you have individualism and that, but this is a belief system.
It's a commandment to believe in God. There's a logical problem in that. You're commanded to believe in God.
Belief takes faith. You can't order it.
Well, it's a commandment, and aren't you supposed to have free will?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you have free will to follow this or not, like all the commandments. But one of the commandments is you have a commandment to eat matzah. You have a commandment to blow the shofar. You have a commandment to honor your parents. You have a commandment to fear your parents, have all of your parents. And now we have a commandment to believe in God.
It's not concrete.
Who's commanding it?
Sure.
What?
If you don't believe in him, there's no commandment. It's inherently contradictory.
It's inherent contradiction, right? Or is it? But that's the question that the Bahag asks. Bahag is another early authority. Can I wear this? Would it work?
Yeah.
So the Bahag asks, Bahag stands for Baal Hilchos Gedolos, the one who wrote this book called the Hilchos Gedolos, written in the 800s. So he asks, or his implicit question is, how can you count that as a commandment? Who's commanding it? Right? If you believe in the commander who's giving us the 613 mitzvahs, then I don't need mitzvah number one. It's a given. If I don't believe in the commander, so you can command me all I want, but I don't believe, you know, let's say I came to you and I said, Lahavdil, I said, you know, Unicorn spoke to me and they said that you have to only wear purple shoes. So is that so you'll say, I don't believe in unicorns, right? So let's say, well, the first thing the unicorn said, I'm just trying to use this as an analogy. Obviously, I'm making a very clear distinction between God and unicorns. But imagine if the unicorn said, the unicorn said you have to believe in them. That's actually commandment. I don't believe in unicorns, so I'm not having a conversation with you about unicorns, telling me they have to, right? So if you don't believe in God, me telling you, or the Torah telling you, and the Ten Commandments telling you have to believe in God, that's not really going to do it for you. So that's why some actually don't say that that's a commandment. They say it's a statement. It says, okay, the following is from me, God. Okay, the reason you believe in me is for what we discussed earlier. It's because I'm talking to you, right? We're standing at Sinai. Remember, this is the Sinai experience. God saying, hi, it's me, God. You know, I don't believe in you. I'm talking to you. What do you mean you don't believe in me? I'm here in the heavens. Talking. Yeah, I just split all the heavens, and you're like having a prophetic experience. They all believe in God at that point, right? Later generations, all right. But at that point, they all... So that's not a commandment, says the Bahag. It's a statement. I am God, and I'm giving you the following commandments. Number one, don't have other gods. Okay, so the first of the Ten Commandments, according to the Bahag, is the second one. Don't have other gods. Okay, but Rambam doesn't learn that way. We just read in Rambam that Rambam is learning that that first verse is actually a commandment. Believe in me. So, again, we have to ask the question, how is that internally logical? How can you have a commandment to believe in God? So what Rambam is saying, if we read Rambam carefully, look at the beginning of number 6. What does he say? Okay, so what is Rambam saying is included in the mitzvah of I am Hashem your God? The knowledge of 1 through 5. Okay, in other words, study and understand what we mean when we say God. Ladies and gentlemen, by coming to this class, you're fulfilling the first of the 613 mitzvot. You're fulfilling the first of the 10 commandments according to Maimonides. We're learning what it means when we say God.
So I got one down.
You got one already. Oh, just by coming here. Oh. You got a few more. You got Torah learning. So the idea that we're discussing, or to understand that God is the creator of all that exists, and that nothing else exists and can exist without him, and that he's dependent on nothing else, right? All of this is what we mean when we say God. Okay, now, why does Rambam call this principle, he says that you have to believe that there's a creator and ruler of all things. What is the difference between creator and ruler?
Well, to go back to the watchmaker watch analogy, right? Once the watchmaker's made the watch, he's done. He doesn't have to do anything with it anymore. A ruler has to rule the kingdom. He's
right
there all the time.
Excellent. So Rambam is saying something, and this was brought up earlier. Somebody brought up the question earlier, maybe God just created the world and walked away. Maybe God created the world and walked away. So says Rambam, that's going head to head with the first principle. The first principle includes not just that he's the creator, that he's also the ruler. He's behind the scenes. He's the king. Okay? He's running the show. So he's running the show, and he's the creator of the universe. Put that into one package deal, and we call that God. But that's not all. Okay? I don't want to make it sound like a show where the knives. You buy knives for $32 a night. But that's not all. It can also do the following. We're throwing in the following. Okay, but number one, the principle number one is that God is the creator and ruler of all things. That's a mitzvah. The first of the 613 mitzvot, at least according to Rambam. What else did Rambam here say? He said nothing else is as real as God. What do we mean by nothing else is as real as God? This pen looks very real, right? This eraser looks very real.
But it doesn't control its own existence.
So why is this not real, but God is real? Or it's not as real as God?
because it doesn't control the building system.
Because if God, for whatever reason, decided that this eraser shouldn't exist anymore, it's gone, right? It just stopped existing, right? Thankfully, he didn't decide that because he still needed this eraser. But if for any reason he decided that I don't want that eraser in existence anymore, it would just be gone. And the same for everything else in existence, including you and me, including the entire planet, and all those billions and billions and trillions of stars that we were discussing earlier, including space and time. All of existence could disappear in an instant simply by the whim of God, okay, by his decision, because everything else is contingent on him, but he is not contingent on anything else. So in a sense, nothing's that real. Really, nothing's not that real. We shouldn't get all, like, depressed from that, you know. But the reality is that the only true real existence is God. Now, we have a track record with God that he's thankfully not withdrawn his desire for the world to exist for quite some time, you know, so we can expect hopefully that it will still be here tomorrow. There's no reason not to assume that. But in theory, at least, it could disappear, and that's really what we mean, or perhaps part of what Rambam means when he says nothing is as real as God. Okay, that's principle number one. Can we move to principle number two?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's go to principle number two. As we saw earlier, that's the idea of unity, God's oneness. Okay, so let's read on. This is continuation of that Rambam. He says, anyone who presumes that there is another God transgresses a negative commandment. As it states, you shall have no other gods before me. That's number two on our list over there on the wall, on the Ten Commandments. And he denies a fundamental principle of our faith, because this is the great principle of faith upon which all depends, right? Judaism is built on this idea that there's only one God. Let's go to number seven. This God is one. He is not two or more, but one, unified in a manner which surpasses any unity that is found in the world. He is not one in the manner of a general category, which includes many individual entities, nor one in the way that a body is divided into different portions and dimensions. Rather, he is unified, and there exists no unity similar to his in this world. Okay? So you'd ask, one second, there's only one David Barkhausen, right? I looked it up in the phone book. There's only one David Barkhausen in all of Houston, and in fact, all the world. Maybe there's more, I don't know. But let's just assume that there isn't. It's a unique name. Only one David Barkhausen. So you say David also is unique. You can't find another David Barkhausen. Why isn't he also one? Why we say that God is one, and his oneness is not similar to anything else in the world? So he reads, let's read on. Were the Creator to have body and form, he would have limitation and definition, because it is impossible for a body not to be limited. And any entity which itself is limited and defined possesses only limited and defined power. Since he is not a body, the circumstances associated with bodies that produce division and separation are not relevant to him. The knowledge of this concept also fulfills a positive commandment, which is Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. So just by believing that as well, that God is truly one and indivisible, we fulfill the positive mitzvah. It's different than David Barkhausen, because David Barkhausen is divisible. You look at David Barkhausen, he's got two eyes. He's got a front and a back. He's made up of trillions of cells. Just trust me. Okay? He's divisible. He's divisible. He's got parts, right? When we talk about God, there isn't a front and a back, and a top and a bottom, and a left and a right. And he's there, he's here, he's everywhere. He is everywhere, but he's not in one particular place. He can't be in one particular place, because if he's in one particular place, then he has a physical existence. He's everywhere, always, indivisible, and oneness. It's a oneness that we're not really comfortable with. Because in our world, I'll take a question in just a second, in our world, everything around us is really not one. You know? Yeah, you know, the Grand Canyon is unique, it's one. But there's a right and a left, and a top and a bottom. Right? There's unique things, you know, there are unique things, they're unique in a borrowed sense. God is the only truly unique thing, the only truly one thing, which is absolutely indivisible. Yeah.
God is invisible, there's never God, there's never God.
Yeah.
And yet, when he spoke with Moses and told him, do not look at me, as I pass by you.
You will only see my back, not my front.
Yes.
Good, we're going to come to that. We're going to come to that. Okay? That's going to be, we're going to get to that in the third principle. Yeah. Yeah.
Why does it say, lo anana, the same commandment?
Lo yiyah. Oh. There shall not be. That particular model just has the first two words of every commandment. It's the whole verse, but they only could fit in two words over there. The original has the whole. So lo yi elochad, there should not be to you Elohim acherim, other gods. Okay? Let's go to the third principle, and we'll actually answer the question. There's actually, I threw out there that God doesn't have a front or a back, and she said immediately, there's a verse that God says to him, you'll see my back, but not my front. And I also mentioned that you know, God isn't here or there. He's everywhere. But one second, isn't there like the presence of God in the temple? And what about, so let's go to box number six. Let's go to the third principle, and I think that will elucidate the second principle as well. It is clearly expressed in the Torah. Remember what the third principle was back in our box. The third principle is that God has no body. No physical aspects of Hashem. So let's go. We're now in the big box that says third principle. It is clearly expressed in the Torah and the works of the prophets that the Holy One, blessed be He, is not confined to a body or physical form. As the verse in Deuteronomy states, because God, your Lord, is the Lord in the heavens above and the earth below. And a body cannot exist in two places simultaneously. How can God be in the heavens above and the earth below? Where is He? So the answer is He's in both. Because He's not like we think of people. Also, Deuteronomy 4:15 states, you did not see any image. And Isaiah states, to whom can you liken me? With whom I will be equal? Were He confined to a body, He would resemble other bodies. We'd say, well, yeah, He's got, you know, He has eyes, but just really big eyes. You know, no, He doesn't have any body whatsoever. Since it has been clarified that He does not have a body or corporal form, it is also clear that none of the functions of the body are appropriate to Him. He is not found within time, so that He would not possess a beginning and end or age. You know, how old is God? Age is only something that's defined by time. God's above time. He does not change, for there is nothing that can cause Him to change. Change would imply that there's something affecting Him, so He cannot change. The concept of death is not applicable to Him, nor is that of life within the context of physical life. The concept of foolishness is not applicable to Him, of course, but nor is that of wisdom in terms of human wisdom. Because human wisdom, when we talk about human wisdom, I mean, you picked up a lot of information along the way. You know, you went to college. You know, God doesn't need to go to college. He, right? He's got it all, and He's had it all ever, forever. So it's not in a human sense. Neither sleep nor walking, neither anger nor laughter, neither joy nor sadness, neither silence nor speech, in the human understanding of speech, are appropriate terms with which to describe Him. We can't really speak of God in His essence as speaking. We can't speak of God as being angry or happy, right? So you'll say, whoa, one second. God spoke right in the beginning of Genesis. God's angry all throughout the Bible. He's happy with us at other times. What do you mean? So let's go to number 12. Since this is so, all such descriptions and the like, which are related in the Torah and the words of the prophets, all these are metaphors and imagery. For example, he who sits in the heavens shall laugh. It's an imagery. It's a metaphor. They angered me with their emptiness. When the verse in Deuteronomy says, God's all angry. Is He really angry? No. It's a metaphor. As God rejoiced, the verse says, also in Deuteronomy. But again, God doesn't rejoice or get angry. With regard to all such statements, our sages said, the Torah speaks in the language of man. This is for us. I think, I've taught classes on this in the past, and this is the point where people kind of get up in arms. You know, what do you mean? The Torah says he gets angry. The Torah says he's happy. The Torah talks about him speaking to Moses. You know, how could you take all that away from God and just call that metaphor? It becomes much harder to kind of picture this being called God. And that's good. It's good that it's harder for us to picture this being called God. Because God is not an old man in heaven with a long white beard. You know, part of the reason, one of the classic arguments against, like, say, the existence of God, and it's an emotional argument, it's not a logical argument, but it's an argument nonetheless, and you'll hear this, you hear it less and less now, unfortunately, I would say. But people less bring this up, but those who are emotionally vested in it still bring it up, and they'll say to me, at the end of this class, they'll say, Rabbi, how can you believe in God? If there was a God, what shouldn't have happened?
The Holocaust.
How could the Holocaust happen if there was a God? Right? So it's a very difficult question. It's a very difficult question. But it's not it's an emotional question. It's not a logical question. And the reason it's not a logical question is, first of all, Deuteronomy states it's going to happen. Deuteronomy actually talks about the Holocaust before it happens. But beyond that, the question is really coming from the following point. The question is coming from the point where the person says, you know what, when I think of God, I think of my Zadie. I love my Zadie. You know what Zadie means? My grandpa. You know, I think of my grandpa, and he was just sweet and loving, and I'd sit on his lap, and he'd get me Hanukkah presents, you know? And that's what I think about God. An old man with a long beard, a little bit senile, you know? And just gives me stuff. and he's always just so sweet, and forgets sometimes my birthday. But when I remember, he feels guilty and it gets me more. You know, that's often what my Zadie would not allow the Holocaust to happen, right? So I don't believe in God. So the person is right. Their picture of God is faulty, right? We have to look at God the way he describes himself in the Torah. And the way he describes himself in the Torah, right, and through our sages, is that they're you know, he's not Santa Claus in heaven. He's not Santa Claus in heaven, right? There's a bigger picture to what we call God. Now, with all the imagery that the Torah applies to God, says Rambam, we have to be careful not to take that too literally. And so, which brings us back to the question that was asked earlier, is what do we mean when we say that we were made in the image of God? What do we mean when we say that we're made in the image of God? In other words, let's reiterate the question, Marsha. What's the question?
Because it's not physically.
Ah, so we can't literally be made in the image of God. Why not?
He has no image.
When we talk about being made in the image of God, it clearly, again, we're using a metaphor. What we're saying is that there's some aspect of godliness that exists in man. And we're calling that the image of God. Right? But that image of God, right, or tselem, actually, and we're learning this on Shabbat afternoon, for those of you who are in the Shabbat afternoon class, that concept of tselem just means there's some likeliness. There's some likeliness to God. And we talked about the spiritual aspect of humanity, that is the likeliness to God. But again, it's a parable. It's a metaphor, right? Not to be taken literally. Let's end with the fourth principle, because we're already running short on time, and then we'll take any questions. The fourth and final principle that Rambam says here in our definition of God is that God is first and last. The fourth principle involves the absolute eternity of the one whom we call God. Nothing else shares his eternal quality. This is discussed many times in Scripture, and the Torah teaches it to us when it says of him, the eternal God is a refuge. And Rambam writes in his Guide to the Perplexed, he states the following, everything other than God himself was created by God out of absolute nothingness. He didn't have any building material, he created the building material. In the beginning, God alone existed. There was nothing else. He then created everything else that exists from absolute nothingness. It all followed his will and desire. Even time itself is among the things created by God. Time depends upon motion. In order for motion to exist, we must have things that move, and all things were created by God. So God, in essence, also creates time. So Maimonides says something very, very important. You know, the children will often ask you, you know, what existed before God? Or who created God? And they're really asking a question that some of us perhaps ask in a more sophisticated way. You know, people will ask in a more sophisticated way, and they'll say, you know, well, you know, what do we mean? There is an argument, and you alluded to it earlier, that look, the world is way too complex to have existed through random, a randomness, let's say. So it has to have gotten material from a previous or further away galaxy that kind of was implanted here. All that really does is it just moves the question further back in time, but it doesn't really address the question. So where did that come from? Well, from the infinitely earlier galaxies and galaxies and galaxies, right? So really you just shifted the conversation from God by saying, well, there could in theory be infinite other earlier universes, but you're really not answering the question. You're just pushing it away. You're kicking the can down the road. Right? What Maimonides here is doing, and what Judaism does, is we take that question very firmly, and we say what existed before time is the only thing that truly exists, which is God himself. God himself made time, he made space, he made the materials of our creation, he put that all into our existence, and including the trillions and trillions of stars, and the amoebas, and the uniqueness of you. But all of that is created by God, and these are the principles we believe when we talk about God. We talk about God as non-physical, we talk about him as being totally one, as the creator and the ruler of all of existence, as being the first and the last. By definition, if he's the last, that means everything that we know will eventually cease to exist. Okay? The earth, the sun, the moon, it will cease to exist. Not necessarily because of global warming, but because it will eventually run out. It's a physical being. Physical things eventually cease to exist. The only thing that doesn't is God himself. Okay, so ladies and gentlemen, that's our class on what do we mean when we say God. And we look forward to having you back here next week at 9:45. Yes.
I heard in a religious setting, God is a man and woman together.
He's neither.
Okay, right. So the point, yeah, that's good. That we use the masculine for it's just it's convenience sake, and because of the connotation that masculine has had until more recent times.
Yes.
But God is neither a man nor a woman. He just is, right?
Okay.
Man and woman implies physical.
Okay.
What?
Isn't it said that God has both masculine and feminine?
We relate to him in that way.
And that the Shekinah.
Shekinah would be the feminine. Right, so that's the ways we relate to him, but he himself is neither masculine nor feminine.
And these are all anthropomorphic
right.
For us to be able to wrap our brains.
Right, goes back to principle number 3. That we use words, the Torah does speak in human language.